Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming to Wat Chet Tai Wan tonight for another Dhamma talk by Ajahn Brahmavamsa. As most of you may know, we also have a meditation retreat ongoing. So our retreatants who are wearing the red color lanyard here, they are in this room, mainly in the front, some at the back. They are practicing noble silence. So if there are some of your friends, maybe they're not so sociable tonight. It's Christmas Eve. So maybe they may not be replying to your SMS or WhatsApp or Twitter or Facebook or Viber, etc. So please have this understanding, because they are actually practicing noble silence under the instruction of Ajahn Brahm. Right. We are very honored here to have Ajahn Brahm to give us a talk here. And Ajahn will speak for about 1 hour, and then he will take questions. We have a question box right at the door. You can write pen down your question. Oh, sorry. It's right in front, so it's filled already. No more questions allowed, is it?
Always ask more questions.
Yes, okay. We'll leave it at the door, yes. So there's about 30 minutes for questions. We try to finish about 9:30. This is also to give the opportunity for everyone who is in a retreat to rest or continue meditating. They've been working very hard. You know, they wake up very early. They start at 6. They're still meditating before the talk. So I think we should award them, you know, some time to go to rest, as well as our teacher here to rest. Ajahn's biodata is pasted on the door, so you can read more about who Ajahn is. And without further ado, let's put our palms together. Welcome Ajahn Brahm to give a talk tonight on the third factor of the Eightfold Path, Samavaccha, or right speech. Right speech.
Okay. So, I don't know. So, this evening's talk is on right speech, and the best speech is no speech. And so now I'll give the talk. On silence. But no, it's for those of you to add to what Lai Peng was saying about this is Christmas Eve. But because we live in Malaysia, we respect all religions. This evening, all the Buddhists on retreat are practicing silent night. So that's what the Christians should be doing. They should be quiet as well. We have a much nicer time. In fact, I do remember I went to one fundraiser once. Always have to go to these fundraisers. And as we're doing the fundraiser, they had a little... it was like a quartet playing some songs. And then the organizer, I was on the stage, and the organizer said, Ajahn Brahm, why don't you join in and sing a song? And that put me on the spot, because monks aren't allowed to sing. But nevertheless, this was for a good cause. So I thought, how can I get out of this difficulty? And when you're smart, you can always find a way out. So I said, okay, for once I will sing for you to raise funds for this good cause. And the song which I will sing for you is one of my favorites by the band Simon and Garfunkel. It's called The Sound of Silence. And I shut up. That's the only song I can sing, The Sound of Silence, and being quiet. Because it is true that we talk too much. And when we talk so much, it's only a matter of time before we say something which upsets somebody else. And that's really difficult afterwards, trying to extricate ourselves. And especially at home, sometimes we talk before we think. And because we talk before we think, we say some very nasty things to the people that we love. And once, There was a man who had said some really nasty things to his wife, and his wife was so upset with him, she threw him out of the house. And he felt very guilty because he loved his wife. He was just, you know, in a bad mood, a difficult day at the office, and he just spoke something nasty before he realized what he'd said. And so what do people do when they're in trouble like that? They go to the temple and see the monk. The reason they do that is because seeing the monk is cheap. It's so inexpensive. We just sit here and solve all your... If you went to a psychologist or a therapist, oh, you pay lots of money. So you get the best advice from the cheapest of prices. This is great value for money, coming to temples. So he went to see the monk, and the monk listened to his problem. And he said, ah, there is a solution to your problem, sir. You have to do the chicken ceremony. Have you ever done the chicken ceremony in KL before at the temple? You don't know the chicken ceremony. This is what you have to do when you say something bad to your husband, to your wife, your parents, or your best friends. When you have very, very bad speech, this is the only way to deal with it, to do the chicken ceremony. I'm surprised you haven't heard about the chicken ceremony before. I give so many talks. Do you mean this is one story you haven't heard? If it is, this would be a miracle. So, the man asked, Venerable Sir, what is the chicken ceremony? And the monk said, well, first of all, we need a chicken. So go to the market and buy a chicken, a fresh one. Not one of these ones you find in the shopping malls in the freezer. Buy a fresh one. And just to save time, on the way back from the market to the temple, pluck the chicken. Take all the feathers out and throw them away. Because I want you to come back with a freshly plucked chicken. So he didn't know what he was supposed to do, but he followed the orders like people do. You know, when monks are monks, we always give the orders and you follow them. But you've got to be discriminatory. Don't just follow the orders without thinking what you're doing or why you're doing it. Because it was a true story. There was a nun in England. She was being driven from one place to another. And her driver asked, which way should we go? And the nun said, straight ahead at the roundabout. So the driver, having total faith in the nun, went straight over the roundabout instead of going around. That's not how you're supposed to drive around roundabouts. But, you know, she took the advice literally. Go straight ahead at the roundabout. She meant go right over it. I said, that's not what I meant. So when you hear instructions from the monks or the nuns, please use your wisdom and don't be stupid. So, no, he didn't know what he was doing, but he followed the orders. He went to the market. He got there in time to get a chicken, and he plucked it on the way back from the market to the temple. And then he said, here's a chicken, Venerable Sir. Now what do I do? And the monk said, wonderful. Now you have done part one of the ceremony. The following part you'll have to do in the morning. And because you've been thrown out from your house, you can stay in the temple tonight. And after the morning meeting, that we can actually do part two of the ceremony. So he went to sleep that night, and when he woke up in the morning after the chanting and meditation, he asked the monk, right, what should I do to part two? So he said, okay, go and get the chicken back again. And he got the chicken, and the monk said, now, retrace your steps back to the market and collect all the feathers you threw out the night before and stick them back in the chicken. Exactly where they came out. And he said, look, I probably won't be able to even find all those feathers, let alone stick them back in. Because once you take them out of a chicken, you can't put them back in again. Exactly, said the monk. That is the meaning of the chicken ceremony. Because once words come out of your mouth, you can't even find where they went, let alone grab them and stick them back in your mouth again. So the meaning of that ceremony is, once you pluck the feather out, it can never go back in. So once the words leave your mouth, it's too late. So you have to be careful to make sure before they go out of your mouth, they are kind words. They are good words. They are gentle words, because once they're out forever. And you can't find them, catch them, and put them back in. And you know, you don't need harsh words to get what you want in life. It's amazing how I can control so many people. But do I ever scold you? No. Do I ever shout at you? No. Do I ever harass you? No. Instead, I brainwash you. That's how to get what you want in life. So a lot of people are really silly. They shout at people, they control them, and that is not the way. I remember this wonderful article which I read on psychology, and somebody sent me in Australia. Because it was this young lady, I think she was in one of the universities, I think it could have been in Monash University, because there's a campus over here in Sunway, and many of you actually go to Monash. And she was doing a psychology PhD. And her subject was how you train dolphins in the water park. I don't know if there's any water parks, you know, here in KL, or maybe in some resorts close by. But I'm sure you've been to those water parks and you've seen these dolphins. They jump through hoops and they can play water polo. They're really smart. But how do you train them to do such things? Because it's not in their nature to jump through hoops or to play sport. So she got permission to go to the water park and to see the psychology of training a dolphin. And in short, what you do is every time the dolphin jumps 1 inch higher, you throw the dolphin a fish. You give it a reward. But if the dolphin doesn't jump at all, you never ever punish it. Another inch, another fish. Doesn't do anything, you leave it alone. And that positive reinforcement without any punishment is the way they train dolphins. And the reason this woman's paper became very popular, and the reason I loved it, was because she changed the subject. She had a good idea. She went back to her supervisor, her professor at university, and said, I've got this amazing idea for a little bit different research. Can I do this? Professor said yes. She completed her research, and it was published in so many magazines. It was amazing research. She changed the subject of her paper from how to train dolphins to how to train husbands. And that's why it was really popular. Do you like to train your husband? Yeah, I want to train husbands or boyfriends, whatever it is. So how you do it is this. It's exactly the same principle. When your husband does what you like, you reward him. Metaphorically, you throw him a fish. Only metaphorically, don't get a real fish and chuck it at him. But when he does things which irritate you, when he doesn't perform, you ignore it. You don't do anything. Stop scolding him. Because that doesn't work. That's not the psychology of how to train husbands. And in this paper she gave lots of examples. Those of you who are married know how the things which upset you the most, not the big things, the irritating things which your husband does every day. And she said one of the irritating things her husband did, she was about to go to work, he was about to go to work, and he was one of these husbands who could never find things. Darling, darling, where's my socks? Have you seen my socks, the red ones? I can't find them. Do you know where they are? Come and help me. And she was so busy herself getting ready to work, and now she had to go and look after her husband as well. And that just really irritated her. And when she shouted, go and find your own socks, stupid, it didn't work. So she tried the dolphin method. when he said, "Where's my socks, darling? I can't find my socks. Or where's my tie?" Because it was all different things every day, but there's something he couldn't find. "Where's my tie, darling?" She would totally ignore him. She wouldn't do anything. She wouldn't scold him. She wouldn't give him any attention. She'd totally ignore him. And of course, he was searching himself while his wife was totally ignoring him. And sooner or later, he'd find his tie. "Oh, darling, I found it." And that is when she stopped what she was doing. And she went up to her husband and threw him the fish. "Oh, you're such a clever husband. Well done." And that worked. After a couple of weeks, she said, "Now he always finds his own things. And I'm free to get ready to work." Now that is how you train husbands. And it's also, guys, how you train wives as well. Stop scolding them. But when they do something right, that's where you use really good speech, kind speech. "Oh, well done. Thank you so much, darling. You're so clever," whatever it is. And you see, the positive reinforcement is always praise. Which is one of the reasons why people get so upset and they can't have good relationships with one another. Praise is what creates harmony between people. Praise is when you feel valued and appreciated by the people you live with. And when you praise somebody, or they just want to do more things for you. That's why when anybody brings me some food I like for Dana, I always praise them. "Oh, it was wonderful spaghetti this morning. It was really delicious." And you know what happens? Then I get spaghetti again. It works. There was a lady at Brickfields, Rupa, and once I told her, "Oh, the tea which you make is so delicious. The best tea of, it's worth coming all the way from Australia to Brickfields Temple just for your tea." And I only said that once to her. And now she always loves coming and make me lovely cups of tea. And she taught Lai Peng how to do it as well. That's how to get what you want. Praise, it gets you everywhere. So if you want something from your husband, stop scolding him. When he does get it for you, say, "Oh, thank you, darling. You're such a wonderful husband. I'm so lucky to have married someone like you. Of all the girls in the world that you chose me, oh, I'm so lucky." Go over the top. It works. And then he'd always be nice to you. You know, there was this one lady, and it was Valentine's Day. Do you celebrate Valentine's Day in KL? Yeah, Valentine's Day. And so he said, darling, what do you want for Valentine's Day? Yeah, nothing, it's okay. Guys, when she says nothing, she doesn't mean it. She wants something. And so he said again, "Now come on, give me a clue, what do you want?" And she looked at him and said, "Darling, I want something with diamonds." That's what women like, you know. So, the next day, he bought her for the Valentine's gift for the one he loves, a pack of playing cards. There's 13 diamonds in there. I think they got divorced next week. But no, seriously, we don't receive enough praise. And because of that, we get angry and depressed. Now look, in your life, when you're at work, how many of you have a boss who is always criticizing you? Never appreciates what you do and all the hard extra work you do. Say, "Okay, But you make one mistake, and they shout at you, and they tell you off. You know, we pay you, we don't pay you for making mistakes like this, you bad person. And they never let you forget it. What's it like working in a place like that? Unfortunately, that is the usual experience of people in work. And if you're a manager or a boss, don't do that. You know, you must always do to others what they do unto you. That's not the right way, is it? Do unto others what they do unto you. You go scolding back. No. Do unto others what you would want them to do unto you, what you would like. So you would like to be appreciated, wouldn't you? So appreciate the people you work with. Take the time to praise them, to say thank you. It's a wonderful thing you've done. Like a doctor. You complain to the doctor, doctor, I'm not feeling well. Doctor, I'm sick. Doctor, 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 doctor. And then when you get better, you totally forget them. How about going to the doctor, making an appointment, and say, doctor, you know that sickness I had, it's gone. I've just made an appointment to say thank you. Wouldn't that be nice? They probably wouldn't charge you, I hope. But at least it's nice to give some positive feedback to people. That's why they say that the dentists are the profession in the West which get most depressed and suicidal. Imagine spending your whole life looking into somebody's decaying mouth. That's pretty depressing thing to do. So when you go to the dentist, please praise them and say what a wonderful dentist they are, and whatever else you want to say. The trouble is, when I go to the dentist, they stuck so many stuff in my mouth, I can't actually say anything. But it reminds me that, I know that in the meditation retreat, talking about dentists, many people complain about saliva, you know, when they're meditating, and sometimes you get too much saliva and it starts dripping down. If that's your problem, go to the dentist and buy one of those little things that suck the saliva out. Then you can meditate without any problem with saliva. That's what I tell people. Anyway, now back to praising people, especially praising your kids. Because that is one of the biggest problems in society in our modern world. Kids getting depressed. And even, this is serious, this is no joke, kids committing suicide. And I'm not quite sure why it is, but so many young people, girls and boys, in our modern world, either jump off the balcony of apartment buildings, kill themselves, hang themselves, and it's something which is very easy to understand the reason why. Your kids feel so much pressure to succeed. You raise the bar so high. Now look, only half of your children can be above average intelligence. Think about it. Say, oh no, other people's kids, they can be below average intelligence, but not my son, not my daughter. He has to be above average intelligence. So half the children in society are having to be something they can never be. They can't all be doctors. They can't all be engineers. They can't go up the top echelons of society and all be monks. Only the elite, the creme de la creme, become monks. So, they can't all be so high. But what the children hear from you is that if they happen to be in that lower half, they always get criticized. Work harder, do more, try harder. And they can't. Now that's where they are in life. And so half the children in our society feel like failures to their parents. Not good enough. Imagine what that must be like. Imagine all the girls, unless you're drop dead gorgeous as a sort of a teenager. If you haven't got lots of boys hanging around you, and you're good at school, and you're good at sports, and all these other things to be successful, all you get is criticism. But I remember doing research. I remember just going in the public transport in Australia, especially just when schools came out, and sitting behind girls talking to one another. And these were the best friends. Another conversation I heard, this is how your friends talk to you. Yeah, you got a big nose, you'll never get a boyfriend. And the friend said, yeah, but you've got flat breasts, no one likes you either. And these were friends spending half an hour on the bus going home, putting each other down. And I remember that's what I heard at school too. From my friends, let alone my enemies. It was very hard to be good enough. Fortunately, I was good at my subjects. I was always coming top. At least I got praise from my teachers. But most kids in the school never got any praise at all from their teachers. I remember that when I became a teacher, I would never do that. I'd praise all the kids, especially the kids who needed it most of all, which are the ones at the bottom. I wouldn't scold them. They were trying their best. Someone would have to come bottom. And that's why, at the end of the 1 year when I was a teacher, I went to the kid who came bottom of the class. You know, you handed out the report cards at the end of the school year of my class. And there was one kid who came 30th in my class of 30. I'll never forget this. I gave him his report card. He opened it, and when he found out his position in the class, his shoulders drooped, his face went down. You could see he was getting very worried what his parents would say to him when he gave that report card back to the parents that evening. Has that ever happened to you? Your child came bottom or close to the bottom. What would you do? Scold them. Tell them no more pocket money for you. No more going out. No more watching TV. No more computer games. You're bottom. You have to study harder. So this poor kid, he was so afraid and so depressed. Now, if you're a Buddhist and you see somebody suffering, you can't just ignore it and walk by. We're compassionate. Go and help the poor boy. So I went up to him, and I realized just how depressed he was and how afraid of facing his parents that evening. And I started teaching him about what we call in Buddhism the Bodhisattva. All the kids in school, they knew I was a Buddhist because we had to do an assembly. And when I did the assembly, I taught all the kids meditation. It was true. Was it 1973, I think this was. And 650 kids, you know, in the school hall. And I said, sit down, cross your legs, straight back, and start watching your breath. And the 650 kids did that for 5 minutes in the school assembly in 1973. Some were Christians, some were Hindus, I don't know who they were. But they all did that. It was only afterwards one of the teachers came up and said, now what would you have done if one of the kids, especially now the 11-year-olds, started laughing? I would have lost it. And I would have lost all the discipline in the hall. But none of them did. They all cooperated. And afterwards they gave me a clapping, an ovation. Never seen that before. It's amazing how meditation is so wonderful that even in 1973, 11 to 18-year-olds cooperated 100% and enjoyed it so much, they applauded. But anyway, at the end of the year, they all knew I was a Buddhist. So I went up to this boy and told him about the Bodhisattva. I said, in Buddhism, we've got this concept of the Bodhisattva. Now this is a being who never thinks about themselves, who's willing to sacrifice themselves so no other person has to suffer. And I said, that is you. You have deliberately, on purpose, by free choice, taken the position of bottom of the class. So none of your friends will have to endure the suffering you're going to get tonight from your mum and dad. All your friends, they're just selfish, they just think of themselves. But you don't think of yourself. You sacrifice your happiness for the sake of others. And I said to this boy that I am going to speak with the principal, the headmaster, and recommend you for the Bodhisattva of the Year prize in this school. And of course, when I said that, he thought I was crazy. But it got him out of his depression. He realized it wasn't the end of the world coming bottom. I was actually praising him for becoming bottom. You're the bodhisattva. You're the real McCoy. And I also told him that in school, you're only allowed to get the bodhisattva prize once. Next year, let somebody else get it. Now you can see that is right speech. It's not scolding someone. It's teaching them in a beautiful way, making them laugh, taking away their depression, and finding some way of praising them, even if they're bottom of the class. Now when a kid hears that, what they hear is, oh yeah, you're bottom of the class. You know, sometimes we always fail every now and again, so it's a big deal. But you're always praised and supported and encouraged. Because when you get positive reinforcement, that's when every time the dolphin jumps a little bit higher. If you get criticism, you just give up. What's the point? No one really understands that I'm trying my best, I just can't do this. You know, there's some blockage there somewhere. So that praise is how you encourage everybody to achieve higher things, better things, and to stop getting into this depression and negativity, which is like a cancer on our society, whether it's in the office, in the home, or wherever. So look, when your wife cooks you something delicious, tell her, wow, that was delicious, that was really amazing, that was wonderful. Exaggerate the praise. And when she sort of burns the curry, just, you know, tone down the criticism. Well, this, I never had this before. This is original, darling. And that way she won't feel so bad. And you can make a joke about it. And we all make mistakes. And that way you don't get put down. So speech is amazing, just how you can create happiness and harmony with correct speech, and how we can create depression, sickness, anger, and just enemies with wrong speech. And if you have to criticize anybody, because sometimes that we have to criticize, as a monk, you know, I'm a leader, I have to criticize, you know, some things which happen in our world, whether it's, you know, people exploiting one another, people harming one another, wars and whatever. But the wonderful thing which is, I saw the Buddha tell the monks this. He taught this in a sutra called the Aranavibhanga Sutra. And I always remember this, and it's really important for you to remember too. You never, ever criticize the person. You criticize the thing. And to understand this, there was a way, this is straight from the Aranavibhanga Sutra, but just changed an example from our modern world. And I wrote this in Opening the Door of Your Heart, but it's one of the stories people forget. They always remember the two bad bricks story, but this was the story of the two kids in the supermarket checkout. In parallel aisles, their mother was checking out the goods, and the person was actually was tallying up what they bought and how much they have to pay. And in one aisle, the little boy took the jar of honey and dropped it on the floor. And it went smash on the floor. Almost the same time, a little kid in the other aisle took a carton of milk and dropped that on the floor. And that went splat and made a mess all over the floor. The mother of the kid who dropped the milk said, "You stupid boy, you careless boy." And the mother of the kid who dropped the honey said, "That was a stupid thing you did." The difference is enormous. You're not stupid because you drop the milk. There are many other wonderful things you do. Just you can't categorize and judge a person because of one thing they did. The other mother, she was the smart one. That was a stupid thing you did, but you're not a stupid child. Does that ring any bells for you in your life? Sometimes you made a mistake and people called you, "You stupid boy, you stupid girl, you stupid monk." People aren't stupid. But the things they do, some of them are stupid. It's a stupid thing you do. So all that kid realizes, he's not diminished, he's not demeaned, because of the words he's heard. He's just focused on one thing which he did, which he can fix up, but doesn't mean he's a stupid kid. It's just someone who's done a stupid thing. We criticize the act, never the person. There is no such thing as a terrorist. There are people who do terrorist things. There's no such thing as an evil person. Even that, was that Adam Lanza or something? The guy who killed all those young people in the school. He's not an evil person. He's a person who did an evil thing. Now, if you use your speech that way, you find you don't create enemies. You don't create divisions in society. But you focus on the real problem, which is not the person, but the act. And you can actually fix things up pretty easily. And I say this because I spent a lot of time teaching in prisons. And whenever I taught in prisons, I'd always have amazing success. And to mention this, to explain it to you, I always like telling that one of the most greatest of accolades I've ever received was from a prison officer in Australia. He called me at my monastery and got through to me and said, "Ajahn Brahm, can you please come back to teach at our prison?" And I said, "I am too busy, sir. I've got to go to the BGF. And all these other places I've got to do. You know, I'm too busy. I can't come these days." He said, "No, please. You must come." And I said, "I'll send another monk." And he said, "No, we want you." And of course, the next thing you say is the obvious question, "Why me?" And then he said, "Because I've been in the prison service all my life. That's my career," he said. "I'm going to retire next 6 months. And I've noticed something very unique. Every prisoner who came to your class never comes back." And I, well, that was just that went right into my heart. I thought, wow, what a wonderful thing I've done. But the next thing I thought, why? What have I done? Why did that work? And I realized when I reflected on it, because I never ever saw a murderer, a thief, a rapist in those jails. I only saw people who'd murdered. I've seen people who'd stolen. People who had raped, but they weren't rapists. That was a difference. Because of that Arana Vibhanga Sutta, were the teachings of the Buddha, which I had read and understood and internalized, I could never ever see bad people. Only people who'd done bad things. And so when you speak, you use your speech wisely. You never criticize a person. You're a stupid secretary. You're a bad driver. You're not. You're a driver who sometimes makes mistakes. That's all. Imagine that you hear that. And all the criticism which you get in life is never personalized. But you're a typist who sometimes makes mistakes. You're an IT person who sometimes makes a computer crash. But you're not a bad IT person. That means your strengths, the good qualities, are acknowledged. They're praised, they're recognized. You know, that's half of what people want in life, just to be valued and respected. Especially at work, but even more importantly at home. You know, that's really all your kids want. To be respected, and for mum and dad to realize they're trying their best. And kids do that. So please acknowledge that. Tell your kids that mummy and daddy really value you. You are really doing your best. Thank you so much. And don't just think that because your kids don't get the top marks at school, they're failures in life. Einstein dropped out of university. So did Dell, who founded Dell Computers. So did Steve Jobs. All these incredible, amazing people were failures. So if you want your kid to be the next billionaire in Kuala Lumpur. Say, you're succeeding, you're passing your exam. Stop it, kid. Fail something. Come on, fail. I'm very upset at you. You keep passing. So what you're doing there is, please, your job is to encourage your kids. Find something to praise them. Because that's what they want from mum and dad more than anything else. Their friends criticize them. Their teachers criticize them. The whole world criticizes them. They just want someone who loves them. A mother or a father who just loves them for who they are. Remember that story of my dad? One of the reasons I became a monk, one of the reasons I'm who I am. He told me, son, whatever you do in your life, wherever you go, however you turn out, the door of my heart will always be open to you. You don't have to pass. You don't have to succeed. My love is unconditional for you. It's a given. Well, that was powerful. Every time I recall that story, I tell the story rather, I recall exactly where it was when it happened. And it brings emotions. I remember my father and how that's all I ever wanted from him. I didn't want the pocket money, I didn't need the food or whatever. I just wanted to be told that it didn't matter how I did at school or in life. I had one person who loved me for who I was, unconditionally. And from that base, that's why I was very successful, because I didn't have to be. That's why I became successful. So please remember now, that is powerful, psychologically very wholesome, right speech. Praise, love, kindness, the compassion, that making peace, being kind, gentle, which I said yesterday, letting go of controlling, being totally kind and gentle, that right intention creates the right speech. So don't go around shouting and criticizing others. And even as I teach in business schools, because that's, I don't know why they do this, they get a monk, as I said the other day, they get a monk to give advice on adult themes, sex, over the radio. They get a monk to teach people about shipping. They get, I gave a keynote address at the 2011 World Computer Conference in Brisbane. A Buddhist monk, what do I know about computers? Very little, but you can still. Why do people ask monks to do this? And you get heaps and heaps of invitations. Anything weird, any weird invitation, those are the ones I accept. You know, life is really interesting as a monk. You do these really strange things which no one else can do. So, you know, the doors are open to you. You know, I told you the other night they had a state dinner with Queen Elizabeth. You can only do that if you're a monk. with no money. I've had breakfast 3 times with the President of Sri Lanka. You can only do that if you've got no money. You're a monk. Really interesting stuff I get up to as a monk. But, where was I? About in business schools, you teach them what is called performance assessment. You know what that means in management? What that means is you've got somebody in your crew, in your office, who's not performing. You can't just turn a blind eye. Say, out of compassion, just let the company get insolvent. You've got to do something. You're a manager. It's your responsibility. But you know that one of the reasons why managers don't go and tell that person, they don't know how, and they're scared, because we don't like telling other people off. It's sometimes when we're not skilled at it, it's very unpleasant. You tell someone in the office off and they shout back at you, and the relationship is really, really nasty. You don't want to create that nastiness, you know, in an office. So a lot of people, managers, they just turn a blind eye because they don't like turning people off. And you don't have to make it unpleasant. Performance assessment works like this. You see a person, you know, maybe they're turning up late, or they're not actually doing the job you expect of them. You go up to them the right time and the right place, you know, not when they're sort of tired, not when they're really busy, not when in a bad mood. The right time and place, that's number one. And you praise them. This is how the Buddha told the monks to admonish one another. Choose the right time and place and speak words of kindness. So you praise that person. You're such a wonderful person to have in our company. We really value you. You're such a good sort of team player. Everybody likes you. You dress so well, and you usually 7 pieces of praise. We call this the sandwich method. The sandwich, a big slice of bread, that's the praise. And then you put the filling in. You're such a great person, but... and then you hit them with it. You know, but, you know, your typing is terrible. You make too many typos. And then you carry on with the praise. But, you know, we value you so much, we don't want to lose you. And say, look, maybe we can give you a course and more training. And when the person hears the praise, what happens is their ears become open. We like praise. Give me more, give me more, give me more. And it takes a lot of praise before your ears are totally open. And then you tell them the fault. But it's couched in being respected. We respect you. We value you. But this is because we value and respect you so much. That's why we're pointing out this fault, because we want to help you become a better person and a better worker. When you hear that, what you thought was going to be a criticism becomes actually somebody likes you and they're pointing this out because they want you to be better. They're actually caring for you instead of just they hate you and they just forget all the hard work you put into this damn company. I've just worked here all my life and that's what she gives me. So that takes away the negativity, which means that we can use speech as a manager. And other people hear us, the relationship is maintained, the fault is pointed out, and we can remedy it together. Now that is modern business practice. That is what works. And my goodness, I think many of you think, if only I had a manager like Ajahn Brahm, our company would do really well. And my company does very well. In fact, it gets too well. I can't get rid of the monks because they keep staying there. When I do point things out to them, because that's my job as a teacher, you know, you're a wonderful meditator, you always come very early, and I see that you've got a very clear mind, but you're nodding a little bit too much. Now, this is how you can fix it up, but don't worry, because many other great monks, they nodded when they were young, and they became totally enlightened. But I've pointed out a fault in somebody, but they couched it in such a way they can accept it. They're not being challenged, it's not a personal insult, which means it's right speech because it's heard, it creates harmony, and it solves a problem. So if you're having trouble with your husband, always coming home late, just get up to him and say, oh, you're a wonderful husband, I like you so much, blah, 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 but... and then praise him afterwards. And then people listen. Now that's obviously right speech. And of course the other part of right speech, I always leave this to the end because I feel a bit of a hypocrite saying this, is people talk too much. And because they talk too much, it means that their words have no value. Gold is valuable. Because there's not that much of it. Just ordinary iron, stone, rocks, they're not valuable because they're all over the place. What is rare increases in value. So the person who talks a lot, no one listens to them. The person who talks a little, their words are like gold. They're valuable. That's why the Buddha said, only talk when it's really necessary. And you find, especially in business, when you listen more than you talk, you get the edge on everybody else. Especially those people who go to parties. Those Buddhists go to parties, but don't drink and don't talk, listen. Then you are like the CIA. You're getting all the, especially when people drink a lot, they let all the secrets out. You find out what your boss is planning for next year. You find out, you know, what other people are up to, because you're not talking, you're just listening. It's amazing, people who learn how to listen and not to talk become much wiser and smarter in life. And that's why the Buddha said, it is the great rivers flow silently, the little streams make all the noise. So ask yourself, am I a little stream? Am I a little trickle? Or am I a great river? Obviously, I have a very little river and stream. Because I talk so much. That's my job. At least when you do talk, it's things which make sense. And things which create harmony, peace, and joy in this world. And of course, you know, you never sort of say things which are harsh and scold a person. That doesn't work, and I don't know why people think they're going to get their own way by shouting. But if someone is shouting at you and getting excited, it's so easy to use your speech to calm them down. When we were purchasing the land for our nuns' monastery, it was purchased at auction. Have you ever been to an auction? Because this is actually how the auctioneer started getting people excited. He said, we have this wonderful land here, 583 acres, and it's such a wonderful piece of land, and there are many people here who want to buy it, and we're going to start the auction off at $250,000, $250,000, anyone want to, $275,000, can I hear $275,000, $275,000, anyone $275,000, do I hear $300,000, and you got so excited, you didn't, I almost put my hand up. And that is how auctioneers work. That's why apparently the adverts on TV in Australia, there was people put a bill in to actually to lower the volume of adverts. Because they make adverts so loud and so fast. That's how it works. Because when it's fast, you get excited and you lose your wisdom. Like I almost did. And that's what happens when people start getting angry. You stupid person, why are you doing this? How you calm them down is very easy. If someone's very angry at you, you start talking very slowly in a low voice. And straight away, your husband calms down. See how it works? Now it's amazing how you can use your speech to diffuse a situation. Just a high pitch, very fast, excitable, and arouses people's defilements, especially anger and even violence. Lower the tone of your voice, start speaking slowly, and people calm down. Very beautiful way of dealing with violent situations, using your right speech. It even calms you down. If you're excited, deliberately walk slowly. Deliberately talk. Whatever it is you're doing, do it slowly. And all the anxiety, all the fear, all the excitement has to calm down. So slow speech is a wonderful way of calming people down and sending them to sleep. So if you're giving a public talk, that's the last time, the worst time to speak slowly. When I give a talk, you can see I modulate the tone of my voice. And sometimes I get excited because that wakes you up. A whole hour's talk. If I talked about the Eightfold Path and number 3 What was it? That really tends people to sleep. So if you're giving a public talk, don't talk like that, for goodness sake. People have come all the way. Make it the speech interesting and modulate and get it fast when people are sleeping, and you get people interested. So the right speech, because many of you, there's not enough monks here in Malaysia, so some of you have to give talks. Please learn how to give talks, and the people will never ever fall asleep in your talks. But if you do want to send people asleep, because sometimes I have to do that, I don't know why this is, but many people say they listen to my talks on iPod before they go to sleep at night. That's the only way they can fall asleep. I still don't know whether to look upon that as a compliment or a criticism. At least they go to sleep. But it reminds me of my last little story before I finish off. You know that as a monk, we always have to look out for donations because, you know, we don't get any money from the government. We don't charge for anything. So the whole of the organization depends on the money you put in the boxes. So I told a story last night about the suicidal spider. Now I tell the story of the monk. He just started a new temple. And it was just so hard to get donations to pay the bills. The bills always went up. And so he went to see the senior monk in another temple. And the senior monk said, oh yeah, that happened to me when I started. Whenever you start, it's very hard to get people's faith up and generosity up. And there's so many other people asking for donations. So he said, what I did was this. I turned up the heat in the hall. Turned off the fans, turned off the aircon, and closed all the windows to make it hot and stuffy. And then he said, I gave a very boring sermon in a monotone, very slow, until all the people were almost falling asleep. And when they were about to fall asleep, said the senior monk, I got out my watch, backwards and forwards, and I hypnotized everybody. And once they were hypnotized, I gave them the suggestion, when you walk out, everybody must give a donation. No coins. What are the denominations of ringgit notes? 100? What's the biggest denomination? Okay. So he said, no 10s, no 5s, no 20s, only 50s and 100s. And the monk said, I can't do that. And the senior monk said, no, it's good karma. So he tried it. He tried it. The next time he gave a public talk, he closed all the windows, turned up off the aircon and the fans, gave a boring sermon, which was very easy. When everyone was about to fall asleep, he got out his watch backwards and forwards till everyone was hypnotized. No coins, no 5s, 10s or 20s, only 50s and 100s. He made a fortune that day. The donation box was stuffed with 50 ringgit notes and 100 ringgit notes. It paid off his bills for weeks. But then he thought, I can't do that every week. They'll soon find out. So he decided to leave it for a few weeks. When he needed some more money, he tried it again. Closed the windows, turned off the aircon and the fans. Gave a boring sermon and people were about to fall asleep. He got out his watch to start to hypnotize them. And that's when he dropped his watch. And he said, he swore, he said, oh shit. I know what everybody did. And that serves them right. So that's not the right way to speak. So anyway, that's a little talk this evening on right speech. Basically, praise, don't lie, don't fraudulently get things out of people. Never criticize a person, only criticize the act. There's no such thing as a corrupt politician. There's politicians who do corrupt things. So please remember, just be careful of your speech. If you say this party is corrupt, that is wrong. according to Buddhism, according to truth. Some people sometimes do corrupt things. But no party is corrupt, no politician is corrupt. Speak correctly, then you're pointing at not the person, not the organization, but the act. And then it can be fixed. Sandwich method, praise, then point out the act which is wrong. Not the person which is wrong, the act. And then you find you can do much better in life. And please, especially with your kids, praise them, because too many kids are depressed. They really are trying hard. Competition is immense. What they want from their parents is to be told, the door of my heart will always be open to you, son, daughter. No matter where you do go, no matter what you do. At home, this is the place for you, where you can always be. Out there in the world, you get criticized, but not here. Here, you're loved. So there we go. That's the talk for this evening. Once again, I've talked too much. So now we've got the questions in the box, which this box has disappeared. It's gone into emptiness. It's gone to Nibbana. No, it's reappeared again. It's been reborn. So anyway, here we go for the questions, and I'll have to be quick again. Here we go. The first question is, dear Ajahn Brahm, I'm confused with the term Sankhara. This is dependent origination. Nama Rupa, independent origination. Some writings translate Sankhara as conditioners and some as karma formation. As for Nama Rupa, some writings say mentality, materiality, some say mind-body. From my understanding, the first translation term is a better translation, the better. Could you kindly explain the terms, and what about the first life, second life, three lives interpretation? Could you please place your explanation using Anguri Mala case, serial killer with heavy bad karma, Sukhunatain Arahat, new rebirth, thank you Sadhu, with Metta Santa Claus. Now, you're supposed to be letting go of all thinking and being still. The trouble is that sometimes, these are good questions, but a lot of times you answer a question like this and it doesn't satisfy you. In other words, if you really want to find out dependent origination, get into deep meditation, then you can find insight. A lake which has waves on the surface will never be able to reflect the moon and the stars above it. The image will always be distorted. Only when the lake is perfectly still, not even a ripple on the surface, will it perfectly reflect the heavens above it. That is like your mind. If you want to understand dependent origination, stop thinking about it. That's like more waves on the surface of your mind. It just distorts the image. That's why they have many different translations, many different understandings. Get your mind to be perfectly still. Then it will reflect the truth accurately. And then you'll find out the answer to that question. So I've answered the question accurately this time. If I gave the answer you expected, it would just leave more questions and more arguments. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in a controlled environment here, I find it easy to observe 8 precepts. However, it seems like hard to observe even 5 precepts in daily life. On the precepts of non-killing, how should we deal with cockroach in our house? I try catching them and throw them away alive, but it doesn't work. Sending metta also doesn't work. They return. Okay, so you must have cockroaches which are once returners. They keep coming back. Now, number one is keep your house clean. And then the cockroach has got nothing to eat. And there's many other houses which are dirty. They'll just go next door all by themselves. Make sure that your doors close and they seal so the cockroach can't come in. And if you do that, it's quite easy to look after the cockroaches. In our monastery, we had a cockroach problem once, and after that time, every few days, all the anagarikas, they scrub and clean that kitchen so they don't have any cockroaches anymore. They were just becoming a bit sloppy and leaving food around, which is why the cockroaches came there in the first place. So remember, cleanliness is next to enlightenment. So, and it's not that hard to keep the five precepts in daily life. In fact, it's hard not to keep them. Because if you don't keep them, you get into trouble. And that's really difficult when you get into trouble. You lie and you get caught. And this is for all the Chinese men. So many Chinese men want to have mistress. And the thing with having a mistress, you always think you will never be found out. Recently, I read this in the newspapers, the head of the CIA had a mistress. With all his intelligence training, in covert operations, in codes, safe houses, with all the operatives, he got found out. If the head of the CIA can't keep a secret, there's no hope for you guys. You will get busted for sure. So the CIA can't keep it a secret. So you can't either. So guys, you will get found out. And then it's big trouble. Keeping the precepts, no trouble at all. Breaking them, big trouble. So if you want big trouble, break the precepts. You want an easy life, keep the precepts. So it's true, no, it's much easier to keep in the precepts. Breaking them causes so much problem for you. Let's try another question. Da, 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 da. Here we go. Oops. Okay. Next question. There is this religious group called Happy Science, who promotes that the creator for all people from religion is El Center. Is that it? Ultimately, people from all religions will be judged by this one God. What's your view on this, Ajahn? Oh my goodness, another religion. People always like creating new religions. You know why they like creating new religions? Because there's a lot of money to be made in new religions. Number one, you get tax credits, so you don't have to pay tax. And you get lots of donations, and there are so many gullible people who a new religion starts, they will join. Come on, be rational. Happy Science, is that science? If you follow science, you will find that the origin of this world was called the Big Bang. And there's no need for a being to create the Big Bang. I know enough theoretical physics to know that, you know, it can happen. If it can happen, it does happen. So without a person or a being starting this universe, and in fact, this is something which makes it very easy for me as a scientist to be also a Buddhist. Just like the Buddha said, this is not the first universe cycle. The Buddha remembered 91 universe cycles. That's 90 Big Bangs. So this, in Buddhism, we've said this for 2,500 years, 2,600 years. This is not the first universe. There's been ones before, there'll be ones afterwards. And that is modern theoretical physics. Now, the brain theory, B-R-A-N-E, membranes, which was developed from string theory, say that if it can happen once, it can happen again. So this is not the first universe. There's been ones before, there will be ones afterwards. So when you say origin of which universe, this is the current universe we're in. And I always like to see this makes so much sense to me because, say, there's many people, you know, Chinese ancestry here. China, before it knew the rest of the world, called itself the Middle Kingdom. You know, where I came from, England, we thought we were the center of the earth. If you saw the atlases, they put England right in the very center. And poor old Australia was down the bottom to the right. And when I first went to Australia, one Australian had done the corrective map of the world. Instead of being down under, Australia was upside down and England was in the corner at the bottom, upside down. So everybody likes being in the center. So all these countries, we all thought we were the center of the world. And then we found there were other worlds, other countries, and it's around. But then we thought, well, at least the earth is the center of the universe. And then we thought the sun went round the earth. But we realized we were just one planet amongst many going around the sun. We weren't the center, almost like the sun was the center. And then we found out, no, that the sun is just part of the Milky Way galaxy. But at least we thought the Milky Way was the center of the universe. And no, there are so many other galaxies that none is at the center. We are insignificant. We are not the center of things. So when we say, who created the universe? Even us, they say we're at the back end of an insignificant solar system on the edge of an ordinary galaxy. We're not special at all. So that's actually quite nice. So all these things, they're quite creative for all people, and all religions will be judged by this one. Oh, my goodness. Now, speak for yourself. Even Christianity, I love some of the teachings in Christianity. Judge not, lest ye be judged. If you don't judge others, no one is going to judge you. Not even a God, no one. So because Buddhism is into non-judgmentalism, to love a person as they are, you will never be judged. There is no such thing as a bad person. It is a person who does bad things. That's how to judge. So, this group has many centers in different countries around the globe. Religions come, religions go. Another sort of cult, another religion. They weren't lost. Buddhism keeps coming back. You know why Buddhism will always be here? Because Buddhists keep getting reincarnated. Other religions only live once and then they go. So we're going to come back next time, so Buddhism will come again and again and again. People get reincarnated, take their religion with them, so we're going to last forever. Okay. What is Buddhist view on organ donation? Yeah, organ donation, piano donations, violin donations. Yeah, we like giving things, anything to anybody. No, you're talking about your liver, your eyes and stuff. It's a wonderful thing to do. I am an organ donor. If I'd have known this question was coming up, I'd have got my card and flashed it around. I've got my card. I've registered as an organ donor, so I am not a hypocrite. You can have my organs. You can have my nose if you want my nose. I always wanted, actually, just because I had hay fever pretty bad, I thought nothing worked. Maybe a nose transplant would work. And because, you know, I spend a lot of time in countries like Malaysia or Singapore, I thought a nice Chinese nose could be good. Because if I had a Chinese nose, it would be actually saying, you know, from my own face, that how I'm into interracial harmony. So what a wonderful thing that would do. And maybe I could have, you know, because I live in Australia, I could have black ears, you know, for the indigenous Aboriginal population. And wouldn't it be wonderful to have a multiracial face with donors. Why not? It'd be good fun. So, you know, Chinese have a white, you know, big white Ang Mo nose. But as far as the real question, the organs in your body, it's a wonderful thing to do. Even if it does cause you a little bit of discomfort when you die, because they have to be harvested just before the actual death is confirmed. But at that time, usually the mind is separated from the body, the brain is still working, but it won't register any pain. You'll be fine. And in fact, you're making that last bit of good karma just to upgrade you in your next life. You may have not made much good karma in your life, but at least the very end, you give your heart, your organs, your don't, whatever else you've got. Remember, Buddhists, especially Buddhist livers, are really good because they haven't been pickled in alcohol. So please, you know, give your stuff to them. And Buddhist hearts are also good because they're very big. So, great, please do that. It's good karma. And seriously, many times I've visited like dialysis center. Go to a dialysis center before you think about being an organ donor. And you come out afterwards and you tick the form straight away. Because people, it's so much suffering having to go to dialysis 2-3 times a week. And they do that because not enough people are donating their organs, especially, you know, their kidneys. There are people who need them. And some of these people you're looking at, they're kids. You know, maybe 11, 12 years of age, for goodness sake. You don't need your kidneys, they really need them. So please, you can have all my kidneys. Heart, lung, liver, whatever you want. So I'm an organ donor. So please, you be as well. It's good karma and you can see it happening. And as you die, that makes you so happy. You're giving a great gift. The gift of life to somebody else. So please, do that. Does anyone answer this question yet? Yeah, that's that one. More in the box. How much time have I got? Do I jump around? Recently my first and... this is a good question. Recently my first and five-year-old girlfriend? I think girlfriend of 5 years. Okay. Recently my first and 5 years girlfriend, whom I had invested all my love and future in, cheated on me with another guy and broke up with me. See, it's not just Chinese men, it's Chinese women as well. When you have equality of the sexes, it goes in the wrong direction. So they cheated on you with another guy and broke up with me. I tried to practice the four ways of letting go as much as possible. Even today, 3 months later, I still have thoughts of her daily. From Buddhism point of view, is this normal? Are there more effective ways to really let go? It's normal. Because, you know, when you go out with someone, you have emotional investment in them, you get attached to them, and it's really hard to actually let it go. It takes time. Time heals the broken heart. And if that doesn't work, the other way to let go is to become a monk. To forget. When people ask me, Ajahn Brahm, why did you become a monk? I said, it's because I had a broken heart. And I became a monk to forget. If that woman wouldn't have me, the Buddha can have me. Isn't that romantic? It would be lovely if it was true. It wasn't true at all, obviously. It may be true, though, because I have forgotten. It's consistent. But no. Just this happens, and seriously, you know, young boys, young girls, if you haven't been disappointed in love, if you haven't had your heart broken, you can't understand what love is. So you get hurt once or twice, it teaches you a lot about life. So if you haven't had a broken heart, you don't know how to love. So that teaches you a lot. So it's really good stuff here. It's the old, you know, treading in the dog poo, I said the first night. It stings, it's terrible, but you go and dig that in, you become a much better person. You understand men and women much better. Next question. With reference to the topics of celibacy and high sex drive. Now, please remember that I think everybody had to write in their registration. So I can check the handwriting. You'll be busted. No, I won't do that. With reference to the topics of celibacy and sex drive, I wish to state that it is possible for a layperson to be celibate. Excellent. I am a 42-year-old male who never had sex and probably likely never. So if I can do it, so can the others. Is this your handwriting? Now we'll find out. Who's 42? That's very good. It is true. Sometimes people like being celibate. It's a choice you make in life. And there's nothing wrong with it. And so that's why that there are many people like you, whoever wrote that question, who've never had sex, and they're very happy and they're very healthy. So these days you have choices. You don't have to do what everybody else does. So you make your choice and you will always have support. I was saying that, I think, in some interview. In other words, some women think they have to get married. And if they don't get married, they get a lot of pressure from their parents. You know, you're not married. Why aren't you married? You've got to get married. No. Some people have a very wonderful life just being single. It's a choice you make. And you enjoy that choice. Yeah, there's things which you lose by being single. You lose suffering. So, you know, you have single person suffering. If you get married, you have married people suffering. You've heard me say that before. It's just a different type of suffering, that's all. So don't think that, oh, you're missing out on life because you haven't had sex or because you haven't been married, you haven't had kids. You're not missing out. Just other people are missing out on just what you're enjoying. So this is why these days I'm very happy to support this. It's a life choice people make. And they are allowed to have that life choice. And I will support you. And the parents who put the pressure on you, don't listen to that pressure. As I said, and I keep on saying, that is why in life you're given two ears. When your parents pressure you, one ear to go in, one ear to go out. Yes, Dad. Yes, Mum. Yes, Dad. Yes, Dad. So, in and out. Don't keep anything. That's called not filial piety, filial deafness. Next question. I saw the dogs having sex just now. This is what happens when you keep 8 precepts for 2 days. You get weird. It is natural for animals to have sex, so it is for humans. No. It is natural for some, but not all. So if you enjoyed that, be careful, because the next lifetime you know what you might become. Be careful. Why does Buddhist tradition choose to abstain from sex? The Buddhist tradition doesn't choose to abstain from sex. It's only the monks and nuns. I'm not going to tell you not to have sex. When you become a Buddhist, you don't say, you know, I abstain from sex for the rest of my life. We never have many Buddhists that way. So it reminds me of a story. Here we go. Going to go over time again. There was a Christian, a Jew, and a Buddhist. And they were meeting together, you know, interfaith, and they decided to have a test. They said, let's just see who is the best. Because, you know, we're all okay at converting people, but why don't we go and convert an animal? And to see which religion is best at converting animals. So let's go, let's make it really tough. Let's go and convert a bear. So the Christian, no, so the Buddhist, he went first to go and convert the bear. And so he went into the forest. And a few days later he came back and his two friends went to visit him in hospital. And they said, what happened to you? He said, well, I found me a bear, and I started telling him about Buddhism, and the bear was really interested. But when I got to the point of, I've got to remember the story, because the other two are easy. When I got to the point of that he must, I've lost the story now, he mustn't steal. And the bear objected to that, so we had a fight. He didn't want to keep those 5 precepts. He didn't mind the other ones and not killing, because bears are vegetarians. So he didn't mind that one. He didn't mind about having sex only with one partner and not lying, because bears can't talk. But the one about but the one he didn't like was the one about not stealing from other bears. So we had a fight. And as we were fighting, I managed to zap him with my loving kindness. And the loving kindness made him all soft. He accepted that. And now he keeps the 5 precepts. He's even shaved his head. And he meditates daily. But you know, this is all the injuries I had. I said, that's very good. That's very impressive. So then it was the Christian's turn. And he went into the jungle. He came out later on, after 3 or 4 days, and he had to be in ICU. He said, what happened? He said, I found me a bear, and I started telling him the good tidings of Jesus. He didn't mind that. But when I started telling him he'd have to give 10% of his salary to the church, he didn't like that at all. And we started fighting. And as we were fighting, we rolled down the hill. We managed to actually to slip in some water. And when he was in the water, I baptized him. Now he comes to church every week. He's a very good Christian bear. So it was a Jewish person's chance next. And then he came out of the forest after about 4 or 5 days. He had to be airlifted in a helicopter. And he was really sick. They saw him in hospital. You know, ICU, many drips. So what happened to you? I found me a bear. And I talked to him about Judaism. He was very happy. When I said about circumcision, that's when I got into trouble. Okay, that's just a funny story. The Buddhist one is, I think I missed out something there. Anyway, what am I doing? So the Buddhist tradition, it's only the monks choose not to have sex. You guys, but not in the temple, please. Only dogs do it in the temple. Indulgence and repression are just two sides of the same coin. Just want to hear the views from a Buddhist monk. It's not repression, it's restraint. And after a while you can let go of the sexual desire, so you have your beautiful meditation instead. The bliss better than sex. So who needs sex when you can have jhanas? Sex is dangerous. You get in all sorts of trouble. You have to get married and have kids. Once you've got a kid, it's a 20-year sentence. It costs you an awful lot of money. If meditation's being joy, and if dancing, singing, or playing, precept number 7, also being joy, why is meditation encouraged and not discouraged? Because meditation brings more joy. So we go for the very best, not for the sort of the mediocre. What is the condition requirement to be a monk? To be a man. The requirement to be a nun is to be a woman. That's an easy question. How to make my wife to start meditating? Very, very easy. Tie her down. Put tape around her mouth. No, it's easy with your wife. Tell her not to meditate. Reverse psychology, that's how you get your wife to meditate. Or, even better, because one of the friends who lives in Perth, she went up to see the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala. Just for a visit there. And I think it's very hard to get an audience, maybe saw him at a distance, but they would meditate every morning over there. So she went to meditate, she sat down. You know who sat down next to her? Richard Gere, yes. Right next to her. Tell your wife that. She'll go to Dharamsala. She will meditate just in the hope that Richard Gere's next to her. I asked her how her meditation was. She said, hopeless. Looking around. After we see the bright light, a beautiful breath for a long while during meditation, how do you proceed to the next stage? Can you share about the different jhana stages? I'll teach more about that later, but you never proceed to the next stage of meditation. You go in to where you are already. And in the middle of where you are, there you'll find the next stage. You never go on to the next stage of meditation. You go in to the next stage of meditation. You don't need to go out of the hall to get to the next stage. Stay where you are and go deeper in to where you are. And there you'll find the next stage. But I'll tell you more about that later on. Oh my goodness. Wow, this box is bottomless. Do a few more and then. If stillness is our natural state, why did we forget and why is it so difficult for us to let go? Because you've been brainwashed by your parents and by your teachers. You know, there was a time you're just sitting there perfectly still. And they said, what are you doing? And you said nothing. I said, great, come and help me. So that is the problem. You're not encouraged to be still. So these days, if someone asks you that question, they say, what are you doing? Never say, I'm doing nothing, okay? I've got all these little tricks. Sometimes I say, I'm watching the trees grow. Have you ever watched a tree grow? They do grow, you know. You have to be very patient. If you look around, that's when they grow, when you don't see it. So go outside, and when people say, what are you doing? I'm watching the trees grow today. You're really doing nothing, but you've got to call it another name to get away with it. That's one of my favorite jokes. And now, because Buddhism is getting very strong in the West, we have real Buddhist jokes. Somebody rang up the monk one day. I didn't tell this the first night, did I? And they rang up the monk and they asked him, Venerable, we need you to come and do a service. I think I did tell this, wasn't I? Okay. They rang, can you please come up? We need someone to do a service for us. And the monk said, sorry, I can't come. I'm busy today. And the caller said, what are you doing? And the monk said, I'm doing nothing. That's what monks are supposed to do. We're supposed to let go, okay? We're doing nothing today. And the person who rang knew enough about Buddhism, said, okay, very good. It's nice that you know that people are relaxing. They're actually practicing what they're preaching. So very good. So he hung up and he rang the next day. He got the same monk at the temple. He said, oh, yes, I called you yesterday. Remember, I need someone to come and to give a service. Can you come today? And the monk says, sorry, I'm busy. And the caller said, what are you doing? He said, I'm doing nothing. But that's what you were doing yesterday. Yes, said the monk, I'm not finished yet. So when you tell someone, sorry, I'm doing nothing, and they say, come on, no, I'm not finished yet. So finish doing nothing, first of all. Get that out of the way. Get doing nothing out of the way, and then you can go and do something. I have two questions. In Thailand, monks have passed away in meditation. Their bodies remain intact, but do not decompose for many years. Is it because of meditation? No, it's because of formaldehyde. It's embalming fluid. No, some people do that. But interesting, I remember because I knew my history, spiritual history. That used to be one of the reasons why they called Christians saints. In about 1300, 1400, a Christian who was a very good person, they would bury them and they'd exhume them after 1 year to see if there'd been any decay. And many of them had no decay at all and they got pronounced saints. It was a miracle. Until there was one count in Spain who had many mistresses who would get debauched on alcohol. He was known to be a very bad person. And he said, yes, when I die, my body is not going to decompose either. And after 1 year, they dug him up. His body had not decomposed. And from that time on, a body not decomposing was never again a cause for being a saint. This was a scallywag, a bad person. Everyone knew that, and his body hadn't decomposed. So there's other reasons. It's not because you're a saint. There's all sorts of other reasons why a body might not decompose. So just because the body doesn't decompose doesn't mean it's something supernatural. Don't be gullible. So the best thing is, I've told a lot of people, when I die, I want to be put in the recycling bin. If you get buried, it takes up too much space. If you get cremated, too many greenhouse gases. But you have recycling bins in KL? Yeah, go, you take the recycling bin, you get composted. A very wonderful way to deal with my body. You can take all the organs out first of all, the rest just goes in the recycling bin. Saves a lot of money that way. All these crematoriums, and that costs a lot of money. They put you in the recycling bin. Isn't that a good thing to do? Is that legal in KL? Why monks must be cremated? Exactly, they don't have to be cremated. Are the relics important? No. The relics. What are the true relics of the Buddha? The Dhamma. That's the relics of the Buddha. The teachings which he gave. The Buddha once said, do not be an heir to my material things. Be an heir to my spiritual things, my teachings. But these days, everybody worships the relics. They don't worship the teachings. They don't practice them. That's a problem with relics. So please, relics are okay, but the real relics of Buddhism are the teachings, not the bones. Keep going. Okay, 5 minutes. Yes, boss. Thanks for sharing the Dhamma through the stories. Can you please tell a story or personal experience on how to deal with anger, especially at work? Oh, there's lots of stories about anger. Now, maybe the favorite one was I keep on telling that, I think, every time, about the person who went to the market to get the eggs for his wife. You all know that one? Okay, so just remember that one. I'll go to the next question. In brief, a guy was scolded in the market and he got very upset because someone was being angry at him and found out it was a boy who'd been brain damaged. And when he found out it was because the boy had hit his head and been brain damaged. If you get scolded by someone who's crazy, do you get angry? Of course not. This poor guy, he's been brain damaged. So I keep saying, if your boss scolds you, it must mean he's brain damaged. Poor boss. Can you explain again on how to find my own breath and how I follow it? Thanks. Oh, just close your eyes, ask yourself, am I breathing in or am I breathing out? If you don't know, please call a doctor. You must be dead. So, just ask myself, am I breathing in or am I breathing out? How do I know? And you become aware of the breath, and that's just what you follow. You just follow the feeling of the breath. Please kindly explain, how do we balance between letting go and showing kindness, i.e. right effort in our meditation? That's going to be, how many more days? 2 or 3 days. So, what day is it today? Today is Monday. So, right effort is number 6. So this is Monday number 3. Tuesday number 4. Wednesday number 5. Thursday evening. All will be revealed. Enough? Okay. Okay. Dear Ajahn, how to overcome restlessness in meditation? Thank you. It's very easy. We have straitjacket, which means you can't move, you have to sit there. You know, your body can be still, but it's keeping the mind still. And the way to be restless is develop more contentment. All restlessness comes because you don't want to be here. You want to be somewhere else. How many of you are restless when you're seeing your favorite movie? How many of you are restless when you're watching the TV? When you're doing something you like, all restlessness vanishes. So see if you can like just being peaceful. Do a PR job on peacefulness. How wonderful it is just being here. Think of all the things you don't have to do. You don't have to go to work. You don't have to deal with a crazy husband or a nag, 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 nag wife. You don't have to deal with your kids. Oh, peace at last. I am free. And when you're content, you're happy to be where you are, then all restlessness vanishes. In Buddhism, we do not believe in God. We are known as atheists. But when we go to some temples out there, there are so many statues that we have to pay respect to. I believe those are more to Mahayana tradition. Are these statues representing the different gods that we have to pay respect to? Or do they symbolize something else? And what is the meaning of God when it is used in a Buddhist context? Kindly seek for your explanation. Thank you, with metta. All these statues which we have, I say the statues are containers. It's the contents are most important. So we have all sorts of statues. We have statues of Winston Churchill. We have statues of Mahatma Gandhi. We have statues of Bart Simpson from The Simpsons. But all these statues, it's just, they're statues, that's all. It's just what they symbolize, that's all. So if it's a good statue with a good symbol to it, fine. You see the contents and that's what you worship. You don't worship the statue. That's a container. You worship the contents. So if you see a statue you like, you don't have to worship all the statues. Sometimes that will take forever. So just choose one, worship that, and that's enough. Next question. There is a talk. There is talk. Malaysia is going to be made an Islamic country and making life difficult for other religious practitioners. What is your advice to us, Buddhists living here in Malaysia? Stop being paranoid. It's not an Islamic country now. So we all get so worried. The end of the world, that was last week, that never happened. So all these other things which we're so worried about, the likelihood is it won't happen. But I'll tell you what will happen. I will make a prediction for Malaysia. Every person in Malaysia will one day die. That is a prediction you can trust. So before it happens, you practice meditation, practice all the Eightfold Path, and you'll be fine. How can my dogs collect merit? By not having sex in the temple, number one. Besides dedicating to them, whatever else are there, I am training her to be a therapy dog. Is this good deed that the dog collects on his own? I wish all dogs, cats be free from abuse, suffering, which they can't do much to escape this life. It's absolutely true, because especially in Asia, cats and dogs are treated quite badly. Cats and dogs in the West, they're pampered. Have you ever heard of these cats and dogs which inherit their owner's fortunes? And they eat whatever they want out of gold plates. And some of these dogs, they live better than the Sultan does. And it's because the Western people are really stupid. But they are. So if you have a cat and dog, sometimes these days people can respect it and love it to bits. Because sometimes having a cat and dog is like having a kid. In fact, it's better than having a kid. You don't have to send it to school. You don't have to find a partner for it. They're much easier to look after. And when the dogs never argue with you, even you scold them and they wag their tail. They're wonderful little dogs and cats. So the dogs and the cats, you know, you want to have them good karma. A lot of times, if they associate with human beings, this is serious. You associate with human beings. Sometimes they like eating human being food. Sometimes they think they're human beings. And that's how they get reborn as a human being. Associating with human beings, that's what they think they are. And they become a human being in their next life. Ajahn Brahm, does reading a fiction book consider breaking one of the eight precepts? It depends, really. It's a little bit of entertainment. If it's a fiction book on some story of the Buddha, if it's Ajahn Brahm's joke books, they're fiction, they're not true. But that is actually... Now, it really depends what it is. So, it is a bit of escapism. But it's really on the edge there. If it really is, you're getting very bored, and you just want this for a bit of relaxation, a bit of playtime, fine. But if you spend all the time reading Harry Potter or whatever else it is, then you're wasting time. Dear Bhante, where has the Buddha gone? He's gone nowhere. He's over there. Is the Buddha still alive? Oh, the Christian's right. Jesus is here. Buddha is gone. No! The Buddha lives. How can I say that? Have you ever heard the phrase, the one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. The one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. Can you see the Dhamma today? Then you can see the Buddha. The Dhamma lives, so the Buddha lives. The Buddha hasn't gone anywhere. The Buddha lives in the Dhamma. The Dhamma lives in the Buddha. So if you can see the Dhamma, you can see the Buddha. So the answer is, where's the Buddha gone? The same place the Dhamma was gone. Hasn't gone anywhere. Still here. Oftentimes it is perceived that it is easier for monks to talk about renunciation because they've already declared that they are giving up the layman's life. But not everyone can just let go and be a monk. What do you mean? That's just excuses. Otherwise there is no procreation. Exactly. That's my solution for climate change. When everybody becomes a monk or a nun, then there'll be no more kids around, so there'll be no more need for all these power stations and aircraft. The world can revert to its natural state when we're gone. So that's a great solution for climate change. Everyone should become a monk or a nun. In fact, because the biggest problem with climate change is overpopulation, look at Malaysia, there's too many people. So the government should sponsor monks and nuns. We are helping with reducing the greenhouse gases by not having kids. I'm doing my bit for overpopulation. So we should be sponsored. Anyway. So, in this case, as you address us laymen, could you give practical advice regarding moderation with examples, maybe regarding taking alcohol, eating habits, chasing goals, looking for a partner, a thank you. Moderation with alcohol. People sometimes say, oh, come on, Ajahn Brahm, middle way. Avoid the extremes. A little bit of alcohol. Surely that could be okay. And they keep on asking me this, and so, okay, out of compassion for you, I allow you a little bit of alcohol, a little bit of murder, a little bit of stealing. A little bit of adultery. Come on, you've got to be moderate. Allow your husband to have a little bit of mistress. Can you do that? No! Why is it we always ask for moderation in the fifth precept? We don't apply it to any other precept. Even a little bit of alcohol is wrong. It hurts. A little bit of adultery is bad. It causes so much problem. Just when you go into court because you've murdered. So it was only a little bit of murder, Judge. Come on, be moderate, middle way. No, it's all wrong, for goodness sake. Keep the precepts. Stop trying to sort of find a way out. Wow, I can be aware of my breath so easily and effortlessly. Sadhu, I bet you weren't aware of your breath when you're writing this question. You're wandering away. That's nothing. That one's been crossed out. Done, okay. We've got a couple more to go. Maybe one more to go. Here we go. What happens if we are attached to the good past experience we had in meditation? Please advise. If you're attached to the happiness of meditation, the Buddha said in Pasadika Sutta, you're going to become enlightened. Attached to the good things. Some things are good to be attached to. If you're riding on the back of a motorbike, please be attached. Sometimes people say, I've got to let go. You fall off. Oh, this is a question for me. Ajahn Brahm, what is love? Does the one really exist as preached by the media? Is marriage for life? I know the man who said, I never knew what happiness was until I got married. And then it was too late. I remember they asked this rich person, he said, The rich person said, I owe being a millionaire to my wife. If it wasn't for my wife, I wouldn't be a millionaire. Before I met her, I was a billionaire. I got all these bad jokes about marriage. Is marriage for life? How do I know if he or she is the right person for me to spend the rest of my life with? What is your advice in seeking a balance between pursuing and letting go in relationships? Okay, remember, a person isn't made for you. You make the relationship. So it's not, I find a perfect person, that's it. I don't have to do anything else. Now we're married, we're going to be happy ever after. You all know that relationships are hard work. So you grow together. You don't expect, wow, we're married, that's it, I don't have to put any effort in. So all you girls, you really dress up before you get married, and after you're married you get sloppy again. All you boys, you're really soft and kind to her. You have to be soft and kind to her afterwards for the rest of your life. So it's not just we get find our guy and that's it. Relationships are always work in progress. So you don't find the right guy. You make the right guy. You make the right girl. You know that sometimes people have arranged marriages and they are so wonderful. They get on together so well and they have a wonderful loving life together. Sometimes you choose a partner and you still can't find the right one. So really it's what you put into the marriage makes it wonderful. So it's you make it the right one. It's not made for you. Could you please share with us some tips on how to become a remarkable speaker, such as yourself? Always answer questions with wit and wisdom. Okay, how to become a remarkable speaker? First of all, you have to have a microphone, a nice chair, have a whole store of jokes, and also know when to stop. Thank you for listening this evening. Okay, do share good merits. Ida men yati na ho tu sukita hon tu yatayo. Ida men yati na ho tu sukita hon tu yatayo. Ida men yati na ho tu sukita hon tu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Good night, everybody. Those who don't die tonight, see you in the morning.